Hello and welcome to The Future of Shopping, a new Vogue Business podcast that investigates what the new era of shopping will look like, presented by Worldpay. Fashion retail has reached a tipping point. It's facing into a future in which social commerce and the influence of algorithms are growing and people's values are changing. For 8 weeks, our editors will be diving into what the new era of shopping will look like. We will unpack what comes next for e-commerce, social commerce, and Web3, and what will happen to malls and high streets, and how consumers will shop in the future. Hello, and welcome to Vogue Business's The Future of Shopping. I'm your host, Megan McDowell, and I'm the Senior Innovation Editor at Vogue Business. By now, we have all noticed that shopping on the internet is a lot different than it used to be. Now in its third decade, fashion e-commerce is facing its own unique growing pains. It's also part of the wider shift to Web3. Web3, broadly speaking, is considered the third phase of the internet, with the first phase being traditional websites and the second phase being led by social media and smartphones. But what does Web3 even mean, and what does that mean for the clothes that we buy? I'm here with Carol Hilsum, who has led digital projects throughout Webs 1, 2, and 3 at Topshop, Net-a-Porter, and Farfetch. At the time, not only did we not know it would be called Web anything, we didn't even know for sure that fashion e-commerce would be a big deal. But after years of identifying new technologies and startups, Carol is now the founder of Studio 3, where she works with startups and investors focused on the future of the industry. Welcome, Carol.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
You know, I always really like talking with you because not only are you fluent in like the bleeding edge tech stuff, but you actually also know the real everyday problems and like the needs of fashion e-commerce. And you've seen it, you know, like I said, from Web 1 to Web 3. So it's really cool to have you here, and I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Yes, many years spent trying to figure out what this digital experience is for fashion in many different places.
Okay, so tell us a little bit briefly about your work in fashion tech, because you've worked at digital innovation at Topshop, like I said, Topshop, Net-a-Porter, and Farfetch in that order. Have you always had an interest in the field of sort of like the future of fashion and fashion technology?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I started as a small child really loving the fashion industry, very much influenced by my grandmother, who was an incredibly stylish person and actually also used to have American Vogue imported to Scotland, into my tiny city of Dundee that I grew up in. So I had this wonderful lens into fashion and absolutely loved diving into that and all of that that meant in terms of this beautiful world. It was very different to my lived experience at that time. Also at that time, my grandfather really loved home computing at a time where personal computers were quite difficult to use and quite difficult to run. So my best days were spent with my grandmother shopping and looking through her wardrobe, and then in the afternoon on my granddad's computer trying to make it do something before the days of Windows operating systems that made things much easier to use. At the time, Topshop was this very epitome of style and coolness for a young girl growing up in the 90s in particular as well. And I was very lucky to start working there. I started working there as a sales assistant, and it probably still is my favorite job ever, working on the shop floor of Topshop.
It's so funny because I can totally relate to that story of like getting Vogue in the mail when I was young and then like trying to download the fashion show imagery on dial-up. And it was like, you have to really pick the image you want to look at because it takes so long to load. Like, I totally remember that era.
Absolutely. And fashion TV.
Oh, yes. So now you've become like a voice known for having insight into the fashion world. Like, you've almost, I think of you as like you have a window into the future of the industry. So let's fast forward just a little bit so people know kind of what your current context is. You've parlayed all of your experience into a new venture, which I mentioned was called Studio 3. And through that, you advise both fashion tech startups and investors. And you kind of serve, I think of like as a matchmaker between the two. For those who aren't familiar with that type of role, before we get into like the history of your career and the details, tell us a little bit about how that works, your current role at Studio 3. How does that work for you?
It's important to think about what the ecosystem is for innovation within any sector, but particularly within the fashion sector as well. That the fashion sector is very much dependent on startups to build innovation. If you think about all of the innovation, new business models, new experiences, new services that have been built in the industry over the last few years, they've all come out of the startup ecosystem. And that innovation ecosystem has startups, it has investors, and then it has players that help join the dots between all of those things, including brands and retailers as well, that could be the end clients for the innovation as well. And so what I really wanted to do was ensure for startups that they were able to have somewhere to garner all of the experience of the last 20, nearly 25 years of building digital experiences for the fashion industry so far. So it was very much that the knowledge was compounded into bigger and better products and business models and services. They didn't have to make all the mistakes that everyone else did over the last couple of decades. And so therefore they could build these real incremental, innovative solutions utilizing that knowledge. And practically that can mean anything from looking at their software products that they're building, the tech that they're building, the business models that they're building, etc. And then on the other side is the investor community within the ecosystem as well. Again, investors play a huge, very, very fundamental role in fueling innovation for the fashion ecosystem. They very much underwrite the majority of the innovation within fashion, because fashion brands and retailers aren't really able to spend huge amounts on R&D and development as you would do in other sectors such as automotive sectors, etc. And so therefore the investor becomes really fundamental in actually fueling that innovation. And what they're looking for is, how do I understand this industry, and how do I understand the future of this industry, and therefore how do I make sure that I'm investing in areas which really will emerge as bigger commercial opportunities within the sector as well. So there's a role to play both with the startup, and then there's a role to play with the investor, and then, as you say, also joining the dots between the two parts of the ecosystem.
Well, we're going to get to that in a bit about kind of how you developed that expertise and in your work with startups that kind of led to this. But I want to back up a little bit and go back to kind of, you mentioned your Topshop days. You started there, I believe, in 2005. And this was like the very early days of fashion e-commerce. I mean, Amazon was like a very new thing. I guess eBay existed, but mainly it was like info sites, you know, like e-commerce wasn't even like a part of our everyday life. So what was the environment there at Topshop when you say you were working on digital projects? What were you working on? Tell us, like, take us back to that time.
At the time, Topshop was very much store-based. So they had a huge amount of physical stores, of course. And there was an emergence of e-commerce, but it looked very different. ASOS is a great example, but ASOS was a very different type of experience at that time. They were doing the copying of outfits that you would see on screen, as seen on screen is the actual name of ASOS, for example.
Oh, interesting.
So it was quite a different, so it was quite a different model. So you would look at, you would see dresses that actresses had worn on different shows, etc. So it was still quite small, and it was quite a specific niche use case. At the time with Topshop, we had the opportunity to launch what was called an e-shop at the time. So quite right.
I love all these old terms.
Previously, it was e-shop. Sometimes the e-shop comes back. You see e-shop sometimes referenced still, which is super interesting to me. But at the time, there was info sites. We used to call them info sites, and where they would have, say, the store directory. It would tell you when stores
like text based stuff, right? Yeah, not so much images, just like text.
Very text based. Yeah. There'd be like one hero image and then text. But at the time, there was this opportunity and this emerging idea of e-shops. And essentially, it was described as the selling clothes online. And it was still very much almost seen as a hypothesis, like it could work or it couldn't work. And this was very much part of the whole discussion about the internet at that time. What was the internet for? What was the internet going to be used for? And could you actually start to sell things through this kind of digital experience and digital interfaces? And so, as I say, we were working on converting this info site into this e-shop. The expectations around what that e-shop was going to do are very interesting to reflect on, because at the time, Topshop used to look at sales based on the size of the store. So really how big the physical store was how big you should forecast your sales, because the amount of stock that store was able to hold. And so when forecasting how big this e-shop was going to be, they thought it was probably going to be around the mid-size store. So very kind of average within the landscape of all the other stores. And actually what happened was once we launched the e-shop, it unlocked this huge opportunity for Topshop, and Topshop.com was making really in the region of what was called 214, which was the Topshop Oxford Circus store, which was the biggest store within the Topshop infrastructure. So wow. Really, it was a huge surprise to people. They just had no real understanding of how big shopping was going to be for their consumer.
On the internet, I mean, who knew? At the time, Net-a-Porter had just started. I mean, I think even things like like on-model photography was not necessarily an understood element. I mean, because, you know, we didn't know what was going to do well. So you left Topshop and went to Net-a-Porter in 2010. By that time, Net-a-Porter was about 10 years old, so it wasn't brand new. What was that like? How was it positioned at the market at the time? And what attracted you to that new role?
Net-a-Porter at that time were really the ones that were very much pioneering what shopping looked like online. And lots of the things that you're talking about and referencing there, such as using models to shoot the items, beautiful packaging and having that beautiful unboxing moment. Those are things that are so entrenched in our understanding of online shopping now. But at the time, there was no playbook. People were creating these ideas, creating these different experiences really from scratch. And as I say, shopping online was really thought of as it might not be very big, but one of the big aspects of the business model was it was going to be quite cheap to do because you didn't need to have a physical store.
If only.
So the concept of actually spending, didn't pan out as we can see now. But the concept of actually spending money on things like models and packaging, and of course Net-a-Porter, very well known for absolutely beautiful content as well and inspirational content around that product, that was seen as really a very unprecedented way of doing things online and almost quite unnecessary, and one that potentially, you know, would never quite work because the whole concept was that you would keep really the cost down in terms of e-commerce shopping. So as I say, they were very much building the future of this type of experience. And so it was very exciting to me to be able to move and start working with that amazing team.
So I think what stands out to me when I hear you talk about this is that we're so used to like plugins and software as a service that just, let me solve this problem for you. Let me solve that problem. But you had to not only invent the idea or find the problems to solve, but then you had to invent the solution and build it from scratch, which I think is like, even things like translations were not automatic at the time. So tell us what that was like. And then I know there's a few funny anecdotes you shared with me, one regarding someone named Professor Barry. So what can you tell us about building everything from scratch?
Yeah, I think it's really funny to go back sometimes and think about this, and especially now, because I still work with product teams and tech teams, and it's funny to see where we are in terms of the reality of how easy it is to do things. And very much it is genuinely, you really have to think back about what the reality was. So when we think about doing new experiences like translation, even global shipping, etc., when Net-a-Porter was doing those things, there wasn't off-the-shelf software to do those things. There wasn't solutions, there wasn't multiple widgets, etc. So anytime that we wanted to build the business by building new experiences, we would also have to think about, well, how do you actually start from scratch and build those experiences as well? And it was very first mover of these use cases as well. So you're not just trying to think about how will the customer react to this, but also how you're technically actually going to build this type of experience. And one very good example of that is around personalization, which we didn't really call it personalization at that time. And I'm certainly Net-a-Porter didn't invent personalization, very much Amazon did pioneer that kind of absolutely deep personalization that we know so well now. But at the time, what we wanted to do was think about how do we use different data models to drive a more personalized experience with Net-a-Porter. So one of the examples that we wanted to be able to do was be able to show people designers that were that had adjacencies with designers that they had already purchased, because we knew that was a pattern of how people shopped. Again, this is quite a new concept that we're having to look into the data to really discover for the first time, how do people really shop luxury and multi-brand luxury? Because nobody really knew that so much before, because we didn't have so many examples of multi-brand luxury as well. So what was really interesting to us when we dug into the data is we started to see this kind of pattern where people would buy one brand and then they would also buy into other brands as well. Mm-hmm. Something that we know so well now, but very new insight at the time. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to be able to start building experiences around that personalization. Now, very much now, you'd probably be able to have a widget for that and tick a box, and that would be quite simple. But an example of how analog and how manual the process was at that time, what we had to do was find someone to help reteach us. Some of us had done statistics at school and university, etc., but obviously very quickly forgotten how to really build relationship modeling models, etc. as well. And so we found this wonderful man called Barry, who we call Professor Barry because he was a professor of stats. He came in and actually retaught us some of these relationship modeling techniques and helped us build this model within the data that we had. And then we were able to pass that and build the logic into our email program at the time. And we launched this email program, which had an extended module in the bottom of the emails, which said what you might also like. Mm. And that actually drove initially up the sales of that email up 20%. So highly commercial. I think we paid back the cost of Professor Barry's classes within probably about the first hour of that.
Oh my gosh. But it took like 3 months to build this capability, right? Like it took months.
Yeah, it took, you know, 4 weeks of stats classes. It took many weeks of trying to build this into the data, then building the logic into our email program as well, just to be able to do actually quite simple and now personalization part of the experience.
That's crazy. Well, I hope Professor Barry is listening to this and knows the impact he had on e-commerce.
I hope so. I should look him up.
That would be amazing. We should send it. So you moved from Net-a-Porter to Farfetch. Farfetch, you joined in 2017. For those who aren't familiar, Net-a-Porter was more of the department store model, right? So it was a multi-brand retailer sold online only, no stores. Farfetch had a slightly different positioning in which it used technology to help independent global boutiques aggregate their inventory. That was its original position, right? So
yeah.
How was Farfetch positioned at the time? Was it seen as more of a tech company, or was it seen as a fashion company? Was it seen as a competitor to Net-a-Porter? What was that like?
What the difference was, as you say, Net-a-Porter at that time, in a very simple way, there was different elements of this, but essentially they bought the stock and then they sold it on to the end consumers and they bought it directly from brands. And what Farfetch did was they allowed the boutiques who bought the stock on wholesale from the brands to sell through their platform. So essentially what it meant was they had a much, much bigger supply, mm-hmm. and almost like an endless supply in luxury products. So supply was much bigger, but the business model was different. For both Net-a-Porter and Farfetch, they started at a time where you couldn't really have full e-commerce infrastructure off the shelf. There wasn't Shopify, for example, mm-hmm. which was actually being built alongside the two of those things. So both of them had to build quite a substantial amount of their technology and their infrastructure themselves. They had to have proprietary technology and tech teams to build and maintain those things. Now, tech teams are expensive, and the margin on actually selling clothes online perhaps maybe ends up not being enough to be able to cover full tech solution type of cost as well. So both of them have started to look at being able to utilize their technology in a business, B2B business model. So actually essentially use this incredible technology that they had built to really be able to sell luxury goods online to a luxury consumer and allow other luxury brands to utilize that technology. But Farfetch was seen as being more advanced in that because they were able to launch what was called at the time Black and White into the market, which ended up being Farfetch Platform Solutions, which was enabling them to utilize their infrastructure for other clients rather than just their Farfetch business.
Yeah, I'm always interested about FPS, as we call it now, our Farfetch Platform Solutions, because it kind of goes like in Silicon Valley, there's this old saying where it's like instead of mining for gold, you should sell picks and shovels to the miners. And so I feel like it's that's kind of the Amazon mindset. And that was the Farfetch mindset, that it's like to use your technology. So I think that's so interesting that that's kind of what brought you there. And as I understand it, you know, I think when we first started working together, you were working very closely with Farfetch in terms of working with startups and helping lead pilots, investments. There's the Dream Assembly Accelerator. I think you led ultimately investments in more than 40 companies during your time at Farfetch, 3 acquisitions and a number of new experiences at Farfetch using these new technologies. So tell us some highlights for you from your time working with startups, or maybe some cool pilots that you worked on during your time there.
What I loved about that time, so really I went to Farfetch and I was working within product and working about developing their actually proprietary tech solutions. But once they had really emerged into the platform model, which what was very exciting about that opportunity was we were able to work with external products and solutions and bring them into the platform to ultimately serve the growing number of end clients as well. So that gave us the opportunity to really go out to the startup ecosystem, see what people were building, new products, new experiences, new business models, etc., and look at ways for us to partner with them and grow new strategies, both for the end customer as well as other clients of the platform as well. What was really exciting around that time, around the 2018, 2019, was it felt like there was a real new wave of builders in the ecosystem. VC and private capital had been very generous to the startup ecosystem and it really fueled a huge amount of opportunity for people that wanted to build new products and experiences within the startup structure as well. But what was really exciting was the emergence of people who loved the industry, loved the fashion industry, but were also deeply digital and technical as well. And so there was an emergence of really very technical solutions, but really understood the fashion use case and were building something that really did solve a challenge or actually move on the experience and innovate the experience of buying luxury fashion online. A great example of that was the Wanna team, who we met probably in 2018, 2019. And I love these moments where you would meet someone who knew the industry and knew the technology so well that I learned something within the meeting as well.
And this is Wanna, W-A-N-N-A, right? For anyone who's curious.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, exactly. Exactly that. So what they were able to showcase to us was there was an evolution in 3D technology. And 3D technology had been used within the fashion industry in different use cases, usually within CGI for adverts, etc., when you would see the perfume bottles float through the air, etc. That was all CGI. But it was very expensive. And what they were showcasing to us was 3D technology had evolved. There had been greater standardization within the models. Underlying AI had helped a huge amount as well. And what that had meant was the cost and complexity of creating 3D, really high quality 3D assets had reduced. And what they were doing then was using that opportunity to build new types of experiences that they thought would be right for luxury customers. And in particular, at the time, they were looking at VTO of watches. And so what was very exciting
virtual try-on,
to us was the
right? VTO.
Virtual try-on. Exactly that. So you use your phone and you're able to, through the camera of your phone or actually through the camera of your laptop, be able to try on something. And previously, the technology wasn't really there. The standardization wasn't good enough. The weight of the assets was too high. And so that's when it would be quite pixelated or jarring to look at. And so you would come out of your sort of shopping experience because you would be quite distracted by this kind of strange experience that you were having. Mm-hmm. But at the time, what they were showcasing to us was things had moved on enough for it to actually be a really enhancing experience to the end customer. And for us, what was very exciting was we always want to bring back the physical aspect of shopping. So we were very excited about this opportunity to bring quite sort of a physical experience to something that had previously been very 2D.
Very cool. And tell me another one I think that I always go back to, I think it was in 2019, was Aeon Group. And now they're like very much involved in the digital product passport space. But tell us, you know, what did you identify with Aeon as interesting? Because they were part of Dream Assembly.
Exactly. Yeah, they did join Dream Assembly. And they joined a particular cohort of Dream Assembly, which was around sustainability. So we had some great startups on that cohort. One in particular was Aeon. And I remember meeting Natasha, the founder, and she talked about this concept of product ID and data layers, etc. And at the time, it was a very new concept. It was hard to get your head around. Mm-hmm. And now we see not just the fact that it's a concept that people are very excited about and building towards, but actually that legislation, particularly in the EU and other places, really want to push forward.
Yeah, and it just goes to show like how slow the industry actually moves, because, I mean, this is 2019 and now we're in 2014, and digital product passports are still considered a pretty bleeding edge technology. They're still something seen that's on the horizon. Like it's real, but it's still seen as like a very new concept. And I think that just goes to show how forward-thinking startups can be. Let's kind of fast forward now to the present tense. I know that we've talked about this whole series is about how shopping and e-commerce is undergoing such a big transitional moment. You left Farfetch in the fall of 2023, and we know now that Farfetch at the time narrowly avoided a bankruptcy, and it was acquired by Coupang, which is seen as sort of like the Amazon of Asia. It's not alone in having challenges. There have been a number of upheavals and changes in the fashion e-commerce ecosystem. Can you talk a little bit more broadly about the challenges that these players face? As we said, it's no longer, you know, it's not a cheap business model. And sometimes with investors, they are expecting a sort of growth trajectory that matches those of tech companies. But these are actually fashion companies. So tell us a little bit about some of the pressures that you see fashion e-commerce facing now.
It is complicated because I think what happens is it's certainly never a demand problem, of course, because you're talking about Farfetch close to around about 4 billion in GMV, Net-a-Porter not too far behind that, etc. So you're looking at really big amounts of demand for buying things online. So it's certainly not a demand problem. Really what we see is they're ending up being a business model problem within this world. And where that breaks down is, as I said previously, building your own technology. And historically, that was how these companies had to work. They had to build their own technology. Is very costly. And it's difficult to justify now why you would have a proprietary tech stack unless you were making a great success of a B2B model as well. But that is a cost in itself, and that cost can grow, and it really never really goes down because you're then maintaining technology and building new technology as the expectations of digital-led consumers change all the time as well. So that's a tricky model as well. The model of actually selling clothes online is also challenging to try and maintain the margin that you really need to have when you're selling clothes online. And there's multiple challenges within that, some of that being macro, and the fashion and luxury industry is very impacted by different fiscal dynamics that are going on globally as well, of course, but also changes that we're seeing within the industry in itself. So the emergence of not just influencers, but content creators and the power that they have to influence shoppers now, and the way that the retailers now have to actually work with content creators, give them a certain amount of the sale, but also work on performance marketing as well, generally, and the cost of that rising as well. So just the costs of actually selling something now online are very, very high. And at the same time where you're trying to maintain technology as well, you just end up with this multiple squeezes on the margin that you're actually trying to maintain to be able to sell clothes online.
And one thing I think we've talked about is this idea of like back to basics. I feel like in this race to compete in technology and to grow and to expand your business model, I think a lot of the companies have kind of lost their eye on what sets them apart, or like the basics of selling something well online. I feel like, and that's not even necessarily a tech problem, but that is a problem that we've seen happen recently.
Absolutely. I think definitely when we look at brands that very much emerged through influencer content creator type of models, where really you're spending a huge amount of money on content creation and performance marketing, etc., and you're really just looking at all of those metrics in terms of a marketing perspective. You're looking at CAC, for example, as your metric that you're
customer acquisition cost.
Yes, exactly. So you're looking at making sure, because so much is spent now on acquiring customers, you're really keeping an eye on making sure that you're making a return on those costs when the customer comes in and buys something. But that assumes really that you always have to spend a certain amount of marketing spend for the consumer. And what we're seeing when brands have really been built very successfully in that model is now having to move to look at how do you have strategies to retain value in your consumer base, or work your product and do your stock merchandising really well, manage your forecasting really well of your product, etc., to try and keep the margin and the cash flow you can have within your stock, which are all very, actually quite traditional retail mm-hmm. techniques for being able to retain value, have retention within your base, also optimize the margin within your stock base as well. And often what we're finding is that's missing within these emerging brands. And as they move from past year one, year two, year three with great growth just in terms of their brand presence and their content presence and maybe their influencer-led presence, etc., you're having to lean on these different areas which they don't necessarily have so much within their companies and their structures, and they're having to build that as they go in those later stages of growth.
Mm. So tell us, you know, at Studio 3, what are the problems that you think tech might be able to solve in fashion e-commerce? What problems are you seeing rise up, or like, are there any technologies that you think are particularly intriguing right now?
I think there's two sides of it. There's helping the current businesses and what they need in terms of day-to-day. And actually there's just a huge amount, we've talked about back to basics, but there's actually a huge amount of how businesses work right now that could be improved through technology, not just in terms of merchandising and stock merchandising and forecasting, but even how brands currently work with suppliers. It's pretty much a paper trail still about how that works. It's all done on email, etc. And so there's huge amounts of opportunity within that whole area, sort of behind the scenes, not necessarily obviously at the consumer level, that really could be innovated and really revolutionize the way that businesses work at that level. And ideally drive a lot more efficiency, mm-hmm. drive a lot less overproduction, of course, as well, and really make way for very different models of production, which I think would really help generally improve the supply chain in multiple ways. So I think we've been completely laser focused on how digital experience is changing all the time and how to improve that kind of digital experience. But actually, under the radar and under the hood of businesses within the fashion industry, I think there's lots of areas of evolution that can happen. And really excitingly, we're seeing quite a lot of that come through within the startup ecosystem, we're seeing people that are trying to improve the way that supply chains are managed, lots of just-in-time opportunity as well, which is super exciting to see as it starts to scale and become more of the norm of how the business works.
Totally. I think that's so interesting because so much of the coverage and interest is on the consumer-facing technology, but the like the on-demand manufacturing and 3D design and all those kind of things that happen before the customer is a part of the conversation, I think, are very compelling. So yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing kind of what's next from you on that front.
Yeah, they're the harder parts. Yeah. Right? So they're harder. It's harder to dig up your infrastructure and your data processes and refactor lots of stuff within your infrastructure. It's much, much harder than technically integrating a new application on your front end website. So it is just harder. But I think what will happen now is that technology will get better, it'll get easier to implement, and people will start seeing, as those technologies scale, how much improvement they can have within their organizations, as well as, of course, legislation coming in to really help to boost the fashion and luxury industry along in their sustainability journey as well. Mm-hmm. So perhaps it becomes something that they really will have to do going forward, which is exciting.
Definitely.
There are other much more advanced technologies as well, of course, especially within the startup ecosystem. They cover everything from 5-year viewpoints all the way down to the day-to-day. And I think what's really exciting on what when you're looking at that longer term horizon is not just that the current models being supported by new technology, but really that the fashion model is being rewritten by technology as well. And I think that more so than ever before seems like a very likely scenario in the coming years.
This series is very much focused on the past, present, and future. So I want to get to the future in terms of Web3. I personally, my definition of Web3 has kind of evolved over the past few years. I think traditionally, traditionalists would consider Web3 to be very much blockchain-based, autonomous, shared ownership, transparency. But when I think more broadly of Web3, I think there's different ways to define it. How do you personally define Web3?
I think I try and have the most vanilla, broad definition of Web3. But I think for me, Web3 is very much technology based on blockchain infrastructure. Mm-hmm. I think what is so particularly interesting about Web3 is how much it starts to be able to be defined in non-technical terms as well. Mm-hmm. Because if you say something like Web3 culture, people will know what that means. They'll think, oh, it's about community and people collaborating together on different projects, etc. So I think that's where the definition for me can be quite clearly technical, but I think you can see certainly the influence start to turn up in lots of different ways as well. And I think Web3 in particular influenced the fashion industry, and especially the luxury industry, because they were seeing, certainly in that the NFT wave, the ability for these groups of individuals to create scarcity in assets, mm-hmm. create community around that asset, create price inflation around that asset, create status around an asset, all of these things which are the underpinnings of luxury as well. Mm-hmm. So they were incredibly interested in it. Obviously, some brands got very directly involved, but I know all brands were incredibly interested in that wave of Web3 and will certainly stay very connected, I think, as it evolves into whatever it comes next.
So, would you consider that to be your prediction or your unexpected prediction for the future of shopping on the internet? I know that's a hard one. So even if it's just like a 2-year plan, what would you say? What does that look like to you?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of different ways. I think Web3 could be very interesting. I'm very interested to see how the use cases evolve that could be deeply applicable to luxury in the fashion industry. For me, one thing that's incredibly interesting, having built a lot of loyalty programs, cash-based loyalty programs, and know the reality of how difficult it is to really create incremental value through a cash-based loyalty program. And I mean cash as in giving money off and giving money incentives to people to increase their loyalty. what's very interesting to me is what tokenization does to that model. And we are seeing some people being able to start to build tokenized models of loyalty. It's not a new use case. We've seen digital incentives used very successfully in the gaming sector, etc. And I think it's only really a matter of time before we start seeing real solutions that can unlock the opportunity to drive loyalty and incentivization and gamification through tokenomics, basically, instead of cash-based loyalty. And that will be something that I'll be very interested in. I think the other interesting area, I hate to talk about AI.
Okay.
Like I'm going to do that. AI. But I think what we're seeing is a real opportunity for some very nuanced, specific AI use cases within the fashion industry. A very emerging concept, which is very in its early days, is what would an LLM for the fashion industry look like. And we're starting
to build large language model
for the industry.
Yeah.
Now, what we see within the wider AI ecosystem is these underlying big models that we all know and are starting to use, etc., being the basis of opportunities of smaller models and applications, etc. Now, within the fashion industry and the luxury industry, we don't necessarily have these central pots of data, but we do have real opportunities and real use cases for their usage. A good example of this is in secondhand pricing, secondhand product. A trend that I definitely think will grow and we'll start to see more and more growing of the secondhand market, especially in luxury. A challenge within the secondhand market is pricing. So figuring out what the pricing model should be and also identifying the products as well. Now, this isn't usually seen as proprietary IP data, which allows the thinking behind, well, maybe you could have a central model for identifying product, secondhand product, once it's been purchased once, and also a model which can predict well the pricing of this product as well. And this could be a centralized LLM model for the future. And there's lots of different versions that I think could be very interesting, because at the moment, smaller models are being built within different companies. But actually, if you were just able to think about it in more of that kind of open source tech thinking, and actually say, if we built some of these models centrally and allowed people to use them to build new applications and experiences on the top of them, that could 10x innovation in our sector. And so why not do that?
Absolutely. No, I think that's super interesting and a great point. So as we're coming to the end, I wanted to ask you quickly, because there's a lot of buzzwords in this space, as we know. So you've already mentioned AI, which is not a buzzword.
I think I've used
not really.
Used a few of them.
You've been good. There's a few left. So I want to just like literally one sentence response to words that I think have contradictory responses. Some people love them, some people hate them. So I'm just going to throw words at you and see what you say. Like, okay, ready?
Okay.
First word.
Ready.
Fidgetal.
So I think I admitted to you one time on a different thing that I find it really difficult to say fidgetal.
Okay.
I don't know why, but fidgetal I like. So this is the merge of physical assets and digital assets.
Yes.
Should I define them or should I just say how I feel about them?
No, I mean, just how you, I personally like the word because it does the job. It describes it in one quick word. It saves ink. But people just hate that word. So like, are you embarrassed to use it?
I'm not embarrassed to use it. I'm embarrassed to mispronounce it because I always think I'm going to say physical.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, so.
No, I like fidgetal. I think it's probably still quite nuanced in terms of what it actually means.
Yes, okay.
Which is probably what people maybe don't like about it.
Great answer. Next one, NFT.
NFT, that is an interesting one. Very interesting in terms of what does it actually mean? Because at one point it meant the technical standard that allowed for that certain type of asset to be created on the blockchain, but it went by a different technical name and then it became NFT. I think it's one where it's difficult to understand now because it means something. It means so much
right.
from a consumer perspective. I do think startups are still trying to use the word NFT actually more for the technical structure of what they're trying to build in the blockchain. And maybe that's not so helpful anymore. So yeah, that's definitely a tricky one, I think, NFT.
Well, I think that's why people are using digital collectible now, I feel like.
I like digital collectible, actually. Yes, I like that one.
Final word, everyone's favorite, metaverse.
Metaverse. Oh. Yes, metaverse. Yeah, I would actually probably struggle to know how people are defining metaverse right now. I think it's meant lots of different things.
Yeah.
So maybe I should think about this, about how, the advice I would give a startup if they started to mm-hmm. speak to me about this type of thing. I would say it's probably not massively helpful to say metaverse now and to have a much clearer definition of what you're trying to build, because actually immersive experiences are very exciting and one that mm-hmm. people are really excited about hearing about innovation. So it's probably best to use something along the lines of immersive experience now.
Okay, noted. Well, thank you so much. Final question. This is hopefully an easy one, but maybe not, because this is the topic of this whole series. Where do you shop?
Where do I shop? So the first time in my adult life, I don't have a staff discount.
Brutal.
So that has been a... So that's a big life moment, a big life change. And I also am older and have worked in the fashion industry for a long time. So I do have quite an established good wardrobe, I think.
Okay.
So what I tend to look at is I do actually like a lot of secondhand. I like to look at specific products, etc. So for me, it's quite difficult to say exactly what I would where I shop. I don't have the one shop that I shop at the moment. I do love the new Prada dresses though.
Nice.
Which I would love one of them. So
noted.
Maybe I'm very more product targeting rather than shop targeting.
Rather than loyal to the retailer.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Now, because I've been very discount driven, it seems.
Yeah.
Over my
Fair enough. Lucky. Well, thank you so much. It has been amazing chatting with you as always. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much. It's a favorite topic. So I hope everyone enjoyed it.
Absolutely. And if you want to learn more about the future of e-commerce and technology, you can get full access to the entire Future of Shopping series by becoming a Vogue Business member. Vogue Business provides a global perspective on the future of fashion and beauty, and it's filled with exclusive insights like these. Visit voguebusiness.com and use the code podcast20 to save 20% on your membership. That's voguebusiness.com with the promo code podcast20. I'm Megan McDowell, and this has been Vogue Business's Future of Shopping podcast, presented by Worldpay. Thanks for listening.